talking about multi-level marketing or MLM companies here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Some companies use network marketing to move product. You can think of Amway and Mary Kay, Tupperware. Consultants get paid by selling the product directly to their friends and family. They recruit new sellers into their downline. That's the MLM word where the people at the top make money, sometimes a lot of it, people below them not so much, and some people lose lots of money buying all the products to sell. Millions of Americans, they're involved in these direct selling businesses, and there's litigation involving these companies. So we're taking a closer look at how MLMs work with your insights along the way. Did you previously work in MLM? What was it like? Did you struggle to sell your inventory that you had to buy? Or was a lot of the job trying to recruit people to work under you? Join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Laura Sutherland is administrator for the Division of Trade and Consumer Protection at the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Laura, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
And we have Rick Ross, who is the founder and executive director of the Cult Education Institute. Rick, welcome to you.
Good morning.
Well, Laura, let's start with you. There are multiple lawsuits pending against the women's apparel company LuLaRoe. And in January, the state of Washington filed a class action lawsuit. Its attorney general called it a pyramid scheme. What is the difference between a multi-level marketing company and a pyramid scheme?
That's a great question, Kate. And it's a difficult one to answer a lot of times for consumers who get involved in multi-level marketing programs and companies. The basic difference between a pyramid scheme and a multi-level marketing scheme, that just rolls off the tongue, is that the money that you're using in the company is predominantly to bring in more distributors of the product that the company is selling. So you're making your money off of the company is making its money off of including more distributors as opposed to making its money off the products they're asking you to sell. That is the key difference in what typically makes it a pyramid scheme.
Well, sometimes it's really tricky to know whether the focus is the products or the people moving in. So it perhaps is tricky to tell what the structure really is to the company.
That's absolutely right. It can be really difficult to tell. And so when consumers are approached by a company to look at one of these multi-level marketing schemes, they should do so with caution, and they should do a lot of research to determine whether or not, in fact, it is a legitimate business or it is, in fact, a pyramid scheme. And the way that we encourage consumers to look at these companies is to really think about what it is you're asking to be sold. And is it a product that people are going to buy? Are you going to be able to sell this product, and would your family and friends buy that product? And also, are they asking you, is the emphasis of the company for you to bring in more distributors of the product rather than selling the product itself? If you look at the financial structure of the company and your compensation is premised predominantly on how many people you bring in, that is a red flag, and it's more than likely a pyramid scheme that would be illegal.
Rick, your institute researches MLMs, and you're regularly hearing complaints about multi-level marketing companies. How have you seen them affect people's lives?
Well, people become involved, and they almost, it's as if they become embedded in a kind of subculture generated by the MLM. That is, they become hyperactive in it. Their relationships become dominated by the MLM culture, and people who disagree with them or criticize what's going on, for example, family and old friends, are marginalized and even labeled negatively as dream breakers. And the focus is on the MLM, and this can cause family estrangement, deterioration of friendships. And it's led to divorces and even child custody battles in situations that I've seen.
You talked about tried to get someone out of Amway once, and it was really difficult. What was so difficult?
Well, the person was so completely caught up in Amway and its influence that they were unable to think critically and analyze the MLM from a business standpoint. The young man's father was a CPA and a member of a large accounting firm. And his son was a business major at a university. And he was planning on dropping out of school to go full time with Amway because he saw that as his future. But yet his father kept pointing out, you're actually losing money and you're not going anywhere. And the business plan is flawed. And I think where the son finally realized that something was really wrong was when we brought up the issue of how coercive persuasion and manipulation works. And we looked at some of the tricks that groups called cults use to gain undue influence over people. And we could see parallels in the way he was recruited and his membership was retained within Amway.
We're talking about multi-level marketing with Rick Ross. His organization researches what attracts people to these MLM companies. We also have Laura Sutherland with us. She's from Wisconsin's Consumer Protection Agency, gathering your thoughts as well. What questions do you have about multi-level marketing? Did you previously work for an MLM? What was that like? Join our conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Laura, how often does your agency get complaints about multi-level marketing companies or pyramid schemes that went wrong? What is that complaint level like?
So that's a good question. We do get some complaints, and we do have a couple active investigations right now, but it is not an industry that generates a lot of complaints, and perhaps in part from what Rick Ross was just describing. Oftentimes, by the time a consumer is aware that they've been taken advantage of, or that in fact that the MLM or the pyramid scheme is a scam, they have invested a significant amount of money. There's a significant amount of information that's been given to them. They have a lot of contracts and tutorials, et cetera, and they're quite vested personally. And I think it's difficult for consumers often to recognize that they've been scammed at that point and that it is not their fault and that, in fact, the company has predatory practices. So oftentimes consumers will blame themselves and will not be inclined to file a complaint. The other reason that you don't often see a lot of complaints is consumers may not understand that they're being scammed. They may think that there's an issue that they believe in with the company's purposes and that they believe they should be making money. And the reason they're not making money is not their fault. And that if they had just followed the protocol, in fact, they would be compensated the way they were promised at the beginning. So we often don't see a significant number of complaints in this space, but that doesn't mean that we don't look at it because some complaints, one in and of itself, can instigate an investigation and have us look into a company because, of course, as a consumer protection agency, we understand the red flags for a company like this. So a single complaint can actually make quite a big difference for our investigative powers.
We're learning about MLM's multi-level marketing businesses with Rick Ross studying the attraction to them and Laura Sutherland from Wisconsin's Consumer Protection Agency. Social media has given rise to a new platform and access to a new generation of people who are recruited into MLMs selling essential oils like doTERRA or leggings from LuLaRoe. Have you worked for a multi-level marketing company? Do you think MLMs are misunderstood and that yours is different? What has working for an MLM afforded you to do? And what do you want to ask about how they work? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back in just a minute for more conversation here on the Ideas Network. Talking about MLMs, multi-level marketing companies, here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we've seen the MLM story show up recently in media. Showtime is set to debut a dark comedy series next month about a woman whose life is destroyed by a pyramid scheme, and it's set in Florida in the early 90s, starring Kirsten Dunst. A recent Vice documentary focuses on the real-life clothing apparel company LuLaRoe that's embroiled in litigation by consultants who are in this MLM. And one woman describes what happened when she announced on social media her intent to leave LuLaRoe.
The more I spoke out, the more I shared my story, the more friends unfriended me. It's just, it's mind games. It's cult mind games.
Do you know someone who works for an MLM? Have you been trying to convince them to leave? What has that been like? Do you work in MLM now, and do you like it? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Rick Ross researches what attracts people to these companies. He stays with us. Lara Sutherland is with Wisconsin's Consumer Protection Agency. Rick, if people are... You know, you were talking earlier about cults and MLM schemes having similar characteristics. Can you look at that a little more closely for us? Where do you see the similarities? Where do you draw them?
The similarities would be in two core characteristics of destructive cults. One would be the use of a thought reform program, which would be a synthesis of coercive persuasion and influence techniques used to manipulate people and gain undue influence. The other would be that once you gain that undue influence over people, you use it to exploit them. And in the case of MLMs, that's for money. And as the woman just said in the clip, she really was saying there's no legitimate reason to leave. And if you leave, you're wrong, you're bad. There's something wrong with you, not anything wrong with the MLM. And there, again, is a characteristic of an MLM that's cult-like, is that the business plan is essentially perfect, and that if you question the business plan, you must be wrong. Now, in conventional business, business plans are always tweaked, revised, improved, changed, but the MLM claims this kind of... perfection that really doesn't exist in the business world. And so you have to ask yourself, well, why is that? What's going on here? And when people question what's happening, or they raise issues like, I'm not making any money, I'm losing money, it's always you that's wrong. It's never the MLM that has problems. For example, that there are too many distributors in a given area, and the market saturation point is ridiculous. And it's very difficult for you as a distributor to make money when there are so many others working in your area. Instead of questioning that, it's always the MLM participant that is scapegoated. You're not working the plan right. There's something wrong with you. And this blaming and shaming and this exaggerated claim of perfection is very much in the genre of groups that have been called cults.
Let's take a call now. Emily is joining us with thoughts on this. Hi, Emily.
Oh, hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
So actually, I was just listening to the comments that your guest just made, and that was part of my question or comment. You know, they always hold up the example, well, this person is doing it and they're making it, and so why can't you? And my question was, with MLMs versus pyramid schemes, with an MLM, is it possible for everybody to make a lot of money? Because from what intuitively I know of this structure, it is designed that the people on top make the most money and the people on the bottom are scrambling. But I feel like with the MLMs, they're like, oh, no, it's not a pyramid scheme. Everybody can make this money. Can you answer that question for me?
So, Emily, and you, if I could ask, you're involved in doTERRA with the essential oils?
Yes.
Yeah. How long have you been?
And I did Jamberries for a while. doTERRA, I've been with probably 5 years.
Okay. Yeah. Why did you decide to do doTERRA, if I may ask?
Well, I'm a massage therapist, and I had taken a lot of aromatherapy courses, and the oils are very high quality. They really are. They are very, very high quality product. And they work really well for therapeutic and energy work and things of that nature. Now I look at it and they're extremely expensive. There's a new company out called Revive, and their oils are really nice and they have all the scientific background that doTERRA does, and they're less than half of what they cost. And then you start to realize, oh, because 50% of the oil that you buy from doTERRA goes to commission.
Emily, thanks so much for the call. Laura, how would you respond there?
So, Emily, that's a great question. And I think you are starting to ask the questions yourself that you should be asking about a company. And as we said at the beginning of the hour, or the top of the hour, if the money that you're making or your promise to be made is premised on either bringing in more people or it's premised on the products that you're buying, if you're required to buy a significant amount of product in order to make money, then that is obviously going to be a red flag and lean it towards a pyramid scheme. If you have a product that you're able to sell and you can walk away from the multi-level marketing company, you can get a refund for the product that you may have stockpiled that you're trying to sell. If you are not required to buy bonus products. Things of that nature are a good indicator of whether or not it's a legitimate multi-level marketing company.
Yeah.
I'm having trouble with that word today. But certainly what we encourage consumers to do when they're thinking about doing this is really do their homework on the front end. And I think listening to what Rick Ross is saying, once you're embedded into the product and you believe in the product, actually taking a critical look at the way the company is structured becomes more challenging. So if you're approached by a company to do this kind of thing, you should look at their financials. You should ask how many people that are distributors are purchasing your product versus people outside of the company. You should ask what their refund policy is if you're required to buy some of the product in order to stay in. And you should ask whether or not more money is of your compensation is based on who you bring into the company rather than the product you sell. And then you should also talk to people that you trust that are not involved in the company and talk to them about what you're interested in and see what they think, what's their response, and really get an objective opinion about the company. And then lastly, you should look and see if there are any complaints. There are a lot of places you can determine whether or not there are complaints about a company, and you can determine their worth in that way as well.
Rick Ross, many of these companies have a lot of pending litigation against them. LuLaRoe, of course, being one of them, but there's a lot of other litigation out there. You know, why do you think people are drawn to these companies as we see that you make a small amount of money generally, and there is a lot of lawsuits going on?
Well, I think the caller really nailed it. She said they use these ideal examples. They will take somebody out there and say, look at this person. They have this expensive car. They live this wonderful life. And they might even show a montage of photos or clips illustrating this luxury life that this person is living as a direct result of the MLM. And they hold that person up as an icon for everyone to aspire to. And what I would say is, again, you know, Laura's really bringing out the facts and saying, look at where you're really at. Ask yourself, how much money am I making a month net from this MLM? How many hours a month do I spend regarding this MLM? Divide those hours a month into your net and ask yourself, how much above minimum wage or even minimum wage am I making? I mean, how much am I losing? Am I running up my credit cards? Am I expecting something to come as opposed to what is actually happening? I mean, you have to really be practical and look at it. And then also ask yourself, why, if this product is so good, why aren't they using infomercials? Why aren't they trying to market it through a major commercial chain? Why is it that they're using the MLM approach as opposed to a more conventional approach to sell their product?
We're in our last seconds here. And Laura, I want to ask you, if someone you know who might be a part of a predatory scheme, what should you do? How can you help them get help?
Well, you should file a complaint with the state of Wisconsin, and we're happy to see if we can help you and investigate that complaint. And you can do that at www. at datcp.wi.gov, or you can call our 800 number at 1-800-422-7128. And you should certainly we certainly encourage them to do some of the things that Rick Ross was just suggesting.
And we'll have those resources on our own page at WPR.org, the morning show page. Laura, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Laura Sutherland is Administrator for the Division of Trade and Consumer Protection at the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade and Consumer Protection. And Rick Ross, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Rick Ross is founder and executive director of the Cult Education Institute. Coming up, we get an update on the state budget situation with WPR's State Capitol reporter. That's after a news update. Stay with us right here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the state budget on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being with us. Governor Tony Evers is getting pressure this week from outside groups to sign the state budget as passed by the Republican-controlled legislature, and his deadline is Friday. Governor hasn't given really any indication whether he'll sign the budget with partial vetoes or reject the entire spending package full out. So have you seen the budget the state legislature passed? Do you think it's a good compromise? Would you like the governor to sign it in its entirety? And if not, what parts do you think he should take his veto pen to? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Laurel White is Wisconsin Public Radio's State Capitol reporter. She co-hosts the WPR Politics podcast. Laurel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
It's going to be a busy holiday week for you. I mean, something's going to happen at some point here in and around, I guess. We have a holiday tomorrow, Independence Day. So last week, the legislature finished its version of the budget. Help us understand what happens next. What's brewing?
So what's happening right now is that the governor has the official budget document on his desk. So after it passes both chambers of the state legislature, it goes through a couple procedural hurdles where the leaders sign the top sheets. That's what it's called. And Assembly Speaker Voss actually had a little ceremony, which was kind of unusual for signing the top sheet last week and sending the budget to the governor. So right now, what he's doing is just sort of combing through that budget with a fine-tooth comb, deciding what he wants to keep in it, if anything, and as you said, whether or not he's going to veto the entire thing or just kind of make little nips and tucks here and there.
Oh, yeah. So Voss is getting like the optics there, like having a photo opportunity to say, hey, I get behind this budget.
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, we saw him do this on another bill, or actually a kind of a collection of bills, the four abortion bills that passed the state assembly and the Senate, actually, a couple weeks ago. The kind of public ceremony of signing these things to send them to the governor does send a statement, right? It kind of gets the speaker out there and has him say, this is something that I really support. Mm-hmm. This is important. Just sort of an extra PR push to highlight what they did there.
Has the governor signaled in any way how he may respond to this budget, whether it is partial or full veto, or if he will sign it, as is?
He really hasn't. You know, the governor has played his cards really close to his chest throughout this process. Reporters were obviously asking him rather frequently throughout budget negotiations, what are you thinking? What's your thought about this particular provision or this proposal? And what he consistently said to us was, I am not going to make any statements about the budget until I have the final document on my desk, because it does change a lot through the process. We saw amendments in the final day in the assembly, not so much in the Senate, but that has certainly happened in the past. So the governor said, I'm not going to talk about something that in essence, doesn't exist yet. Now he has that. We really haven't heard anything from him in terms of, you know, what he's doing to the full document.
And help us understand partial veto power, because that is unique. What does that look like? What can and can't the governor change through a partial veto?
So this is really interesting because the Wisconsin governor actually has one of the most powerful veto pens in the country. And that's because he has what's called a partial veto power. So under current state law, he can take out words, numbers, and punctuation from the budget. This has changed over the course of the past 30 years or so. There have been a couple constitutional amendments that have passed the legislature and then a statewide voter referendum to actually rein in some of these powers. One of those things that was reined in was called the Vanna White veto. And that was actually a veto that the Wisconsin governor could take out letters from words to build new words, right? Vanna White. And then
Wheel
there
of Fortune.
Yep. And then there was one, I think this one's fun too, the Frankenstein veto.
Oh, I thought you were going to call it the Patsy Jackers.
Right. I wish they were all game show themed. This one's just horror themed. But the Frankenstein veto, he would take out words to combine sentences. So both of those things are no longer allowed, I'm sure, much to the chagrin of many governors, because it takes away some of their power. But they still have quite a bit of power to change.
Well, it shows you the power of an English major, maybe.
Oh, absolutely. and creativity.
Creativity, right. So this budget on the governor's desk, shortest in decades, meaning the number of pages is low. So what is the motivation behind a short budget?
So really, Republican lawmakers that control the Assembly and the Senate were working to do kind of whatever they could to limit the governor's power to use that partial veto. One of the ways they did that was to reduce the overall size of the budget, sort of thinking the less he has to work with, the less he can do, sort of a smaller canvas. So typically, budgets in Wisconsin have been between 1,000 and 1,500 pages in recent years. The budget that the governor himself proposed earlier this year, I think, was around 1,100. The budget that passed the legislature was just about 500 pages. So this is a much, much smaller budget than we've had in the past.
Any indication why that is? Or
well, you know, they were just kind of trying to limit the size.
So they're making a concerted effort.
Oh, absolutely. They this is something that they've been very proud of and pointed out. Speaker Voss has talked about this. He said that they took a lot of policy out of the budget. They took a lot of sort of extraneous detail, kind of fluffy stuff. I think he might not in those words, but those sort of things out of the budget. Another thing that they did, interestingly, was kind of tighten up, or what they've been calling in the Capitol veto proofing, some of the language. So they turned shall nots into cannots. Because with that partial veto power, think about if the governor has the phrase shall not do something, he could veto the not and it becomes a shall do something.
Oh, goodness.
Right. So they did that. They also changed a language that was not to exceed into up to. Sort of a similar thing there. You can take out the not to and then have exceed. So lots of sort of creativity and detail thought went into crafting this budget this time.
We're getting up to speed on this year's state budget with Laurel White. She's WPR State Capitol reporter. What questions do you have about where this budget stands? What do you think Governor Evers should respond to in the legislature's budget? Should he use his powerful veto powers? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's take a call now with Carol with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Carol.
Hello. I think what Governor Evers should do, should start out by vetoing, if he can, the part that says they will not accept federal money for the Badger Care expansion. And I'm not sure what else he should veto, because the problem is if he vetoes it, they might give him even less money than they already did give him, and then they'll blame him for vetoing it, so he can't win that way, maybe he feels. So, but I think he should actually veto the whole budget.
Carol, Thank you for the call. And, to her point there, Governor Evers campaigned on including in his proposed budget the option of expanding Medicaid in Wisconsin with those federal dollars not included in the legislature's version. Is that going to be a major sticking point here?
That was a huge part of the governor's campaign. It was a huge part of his budget proposal earlier this year. It's been called kind of a linchpin of the budget. He was coming up with about $324 million in state money by accepting that federal expansion and leveraging more than $1 billion in federal money as well. So that's certainly a big thing, and that's something that folks who have talked about the possibility of a full veto have focused on. Another big change from what the governor proposed to what Republicans approved is about a $900 million gap in K-12 education funding. The governor proposed $1.4 billion. Republican lawmakers approved $500 million. So there are a lot of big differences between the governor's proposal and the budget that passed. It is interesting to note, though, as people talk about this full veto potential, that hasn't happened in Wisconsin since an executive budget process was rolled out in 1931. So if Governor Evers chooses to veto the entire budget, it's going to be a historic action, unprecedented.
We learned from the Wisconsin Policy Forum this week that the legislature's budget would leave less money in the state's general fund, the pot of money that pays for the schools, the prisons, many other programs. Lowest balance since 2011. Could that place pressure on the state in the future? What do we know there?
So this is kind of a wonky element of the budget. What the general fund is used for is sort of the bread and butter of state government. So we use the general fund to pay for things like school, healthcare, roads, and that carryover, that balance in the general fund is important to a lot of people that look at budgets because they say, we need to have a little bit of a cushion there. It's sort of like having a savings account, a little bit left over, you know, break in case of emergency sort of situation. That will be a small number if the governor approves this budget. I think it's important to note that the governor, the budget that he himself proposed was a similar number to what Republicans approved. So they were both kind of skating on thin ice in terms of the balance in the general fund at the end of this. They weren't unique in that. I think it's also important to note that that is not the only cushion that state government has.
It has a rainy day fund.
It has a rainy day fund.
And how is that doing?
The rainy day fund is actually doing quite well. So the rainy day fund, according to these projections that this report looked at, and they're from the nonpartisan Legislative Fiscal Bureau, so that's where they got these numbers, a very solid source. The rainy day fund is going to have about $617 million in it, which is huge. For a little context, in 2011, it had just about $2
million. So it's grown.
That's really grown. But I think what people are pointing to is when you look at the combination of the rainy day fund and the balance in the general fund put together, it's still a smaller number than most people, or at least watchers of this perspective would like.
Talking about the state budget on the governor's desk, and you can join in the conversation. Do you support the budget hiking vehicle registration, title fees to pay for road repairs? How do you feel about rejecting Medicaid expansion? Join in at 800-642-1234. State Capitol reporter Laurel White is here taking your questions, gathering your insights. We'll be back in a minute on the Ideas Network. Talking about the two-year budget passed by the legislature, now on Governor Evers' desk. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. The state budget under review by the governor would leave Wisconsin with the smallest balance of money in the bank since 2011. It's according to a report out from the Wisconsin Policy Forum. It's a public policy think tank. So what do you make of that state balance sheet? Are you comfortable with that spending plan? If you were governor, what action would you take on the budget? How does this budget stack up in the areas of healthcare and education? Join in at 800-642-1234. Laurel White is with us. She is WPR State Capitol reporter, hunkered down at the Capitol waiting on this budget action. Laurel, we mentioned K-12 schools earlier. Even though the legislature approved significantly less money than the governor had wanted, the amount would still be more than the last budget. How are education groups viewing this increase?
So it's interesting because we actually got a little bit of insight from a powerful education group in Wisconsin. The Wisconsin Association of School Boards sent a letter to Governor Evers on Monday, I believe, asking him to use his partial veto power to increase per pupil aid in Wisconsin by about $25 in one of the years of the budget. They said that if the governor doesn't do that, their schools are going to have a hard time meeting the cost of inflation. So that's certainly something that is new and feedback that we've gotten since the governor has the final document on his desk. Now, that being said, a lot of other groups Republicans have pointed to have said that they're pleased with the increase. This is a roughly $500 million increase, which they say in terms of actual dollars is the biggest one. Now, the last budget passed under Governor Scott Walker had a $636 million increase for education. So we are coming off a couple years of funding bumps there.
Let's take another call now. Kim joining us from Waupun. Hi, Kim.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I really want Tony Evers to veto the entire budget. I want the 8-cent gas tax. I commute 2 hours round trip for my business. For some people, they can't afford the extra $10 or $15 fee. So the gas tax is more, in my mind, more suitable for everybody to pay in. I also have no problem, and I want more money going to my school. I live in a rural area. There is less funding in a rural area than there is in a larger city. So I personally think that he should veto because Ross and Fitzgerald are not the governor and lieutenant governor. And to have them taken away their power, he is showing he's got power.
Kim, thanks for the call. And Jeff from DePeer also called to support raising the gas tax. Transportation funding delayed the last state budget. So, Laurel, where did the legislature find money for infrastructure in this budget? What do we know about transportation?
So Kim referenced it a little bit there. Essentially, what Republican lawmakers did this time around was increase vehicle title and registration fees in Wisconsin. The title fee that you pay when you buy your car, they increased that by $95, pretty big increase there. The registration fee, that annual fee, they increased by $10. And they say that's going to generate a pretty big chunk of revenue, new revenue for the State Department of Transportation, the biggest infusion of new revenue that we've seen for several years, about $393 million. But it isn't as much as what the governor proposed with that 8-cent gas tax increase. The kind of back and forth on that gas tax increase that's been going on for quite a while now is that opponents of it say it's not a sustainable solution because more people are moving to hybrid vehicles and electric vehicles, and they don't see the gas tax being a long-term funding source for the state of Wisconsin. But then again, there are a lot of other people that say the gas tax is sort of a shared burden by people who live and work in Wisconsin and then tourists that come from Illinois and Minnesota and other places that use Wisconsin roads.
Capturing the drivers flowing through.
Exactly. Yeah. They sort of, you know, contribute to wear and tear on the roads. So the argument there is they should contribute to maintenance of the roads.
Let's go to Rick in La Crosse now. Hi, Rick.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead.
My comment is for the first time in quite a while in Wisconsin, I've lived here 70 years, we have in front of a governor a actual bipartisan bill that's signed by both Democrats, Republicans, everybody. They presented it to the governor. That doesn't happen very long in government anymore at all. And when you have a bipartisan anything, the governor should just sign it. I mean, there's no reason for all this diddling around. Just sign it, and we'll all go have a nice 4th of July.
Rick, thanks for the call. Laurel, is the legislature's budget being touted as a good compromise from what Governor Evers had proposed?
You know, there's an interesting dynamic there. I think it's important to note that if you're weighing something as truly bipartisan, sort of what do you look at as factors there, this budget did not get any Democratic votes in the Assembly or the Senate. That was partially because, you know, some of those big things that the governor proposed, like the Medicaid expansion, weren't in there. Other issues, legalizing medical marijuana, a lot of other things Democrats wanted weren't in this budget. But on the other side of the coin, Republican lawmakers have said, we did things in this budget that we wouldn't have done if Governor Walker were still in office. This is a unique budget. One thing that they've pointed to and that Democrats have pointed to is that the income tax that's in this budget is aimed at lower income individuals in Wisconsin. And Republicans said if Governor Walker was still in office, for example, they probably would have done an across the board tax cut that wasn't specifically focused on lower income individuals. So Democrats are seeing that as a win, and Republicans are seeing that as an area that they can point to that they said, hey, look, we compromised here.
So the governor and the legislature, they both want an income tax cut, and they're kind of disagreeing then on how to get there?
Yeah, so that was a big part of the debate on the income tax cut. The governor wanted to fund it by scaling back a tax credit for manufacturers in Wisconsin, sort of limiting that tax cut to individuals in a bracket that weren't the highest income earners that accept that manufacturing and agriculture tax credit. He also wanted to roll back a capital gains language that we have in state law right now for wealthy people in Wisconsin. Republican lawmakers considered those things tax increases. So they said absolutely no way are we going to include tax increases in this budget. So there were certainly different funding mechanisms. But at the end of the day, what Governor Evers wanted to do was provide relief for low-income individuals in Wisconsin. And that's what Republican lawmakers did in the final bill.
Okay, so scenario is here. What if the governor vetoes the entire budget? Where do we go from there?
So if the governor vetoes the entire budget, we are in for several more weeks, if not months, of negotiations. Assembly Speaker Voss told us last week that if the governor vetoes the entire budget, he does not expect the Assembly to come back in to take up sort of a new round of negotiations until October.
Oh, wow. That would be a long time.
Right. So obviously that's going to create some problems for schools in Wisconsin, for certain departments, kind of creating a budget lag there.
Right. Because how can you build your own budget for a school or a district if you don't really know the numbers as to what you can base it off of?
Exactly. There's a lot of uncertainty there that a number of people aren't comfortable with, I think, to say the least. Assembly Speaker Voss obviously has said that. Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald has said that the governor should sign the budget because he's not going to get a better deal. Essentially, Senator Fitzgerald said there was a lot of lifting, there was a lot of negotiation to get to the point that they did with the budget that's on the governor's desk right now. And he said, we're not going to do better, and he might not get something that's even as good as this. So he should sign it now and get what basically take what's been given to him at this point. So some strong language from the leaders, certainly.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Laurel White is Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol reporter. She co-hosts the WPR Politics podcast. Coming up, the companies that build our smartphones and our cars and our appliances, they don't want you or your repairmen to be able to fix them, and the Right to Repair movement is fighting back. That's just ahead and On Point. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.